Blog Talk Radio.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, listeners, and welcome to Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio. It is May 12, 2013, and we are broadcasting live from Seattle, Washington on the Seika Network right here on Blog Talk Radio. We've got our show link up, so if you're listening live, please take note of our guest call-in number, 347-677-0699. Feel free to call in. At any time during the show, we've got three wonderful guests that are going to be joining us today. So before we get the show rolling, I'd like to bring out my co-host and brother in the martial arts, Sifu Robert Deal. Sifu Bob, how you doing today?
I'm doing very well. You know, summer's hit early here in L.A. It was in the 90s today and supposed to be in the 100s tomorrow.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's so hot right now. My daughter got braces this week, or getting them. She got the spacers in, so she's in a lot of pain. And I just want to wish everybody out there that's listening, all the mothers, a very happy Mother's Day.
Yes.
Which brings me to a funny story. Sifu Rusty posted a picture today I thought was very cute, that she had an archived picture of her mother holding her as a baby, and then one of her very good friends posted, "Yeah, and you haven't grown an inch."
Yeah, I gotta love that guy.
I know, and I thought, wow, that really, really sounds like something I would have said, and I was trying to be nice that you're going to come visit me in 6 weeks.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought. I'm like, that sounds like something Sifu Bob would say.
That's right. So anyway, so Masters is coming along. The seminars are going well. I'm having trouble filling up the instructor slots to Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they've had some interest, a lot of people coming in on Friday, not a lot of instructors are going to be there. So far, we have David Dye on Friday from 12 to 1. He's going to be teaching the Hawaiian art of bone breaking, the art of lua.
Mm-hmm.
Then 4 to 5, we've got Joe Ordaz. He's going to be teaching intro to motion picture fight choreography.
Mm-hmm.
Then Saturday, 7:30 to 8:30, I'm going to be teaching a seminar on Kang Shuan Do, push-pull concepts. Then you step in, and you're going to be teaching from 8:30 to 9:30, Tai Chi flow for any martial artist, 10 form.
Mm-hmm.
9:30 to 10:30, Grandmaster Mark Shuey, we've got teaching cane techniques. 10:30 to 11:30, we've got Mike Sandoz teaching combative kung fu. We are then taking a half an hour for lunch, then from 12 to 1. Silky Greg Wooldridge is teaching something very, very important. If you ever use your martial art to defend yourself, the number one thing you want to do is keep yourself out of jail. So legality of force. 1
very
to 3,
cool.
Professor Barbara White is going to be teaching Kempo and women's self-defense class. And from 3 to 4, Sensei Michael Rivera is coming in, and he is going to teach Lima Lama.
Awesome. That sounds like a great lineup. I'm pretty excited.
So am I. And of course, our first guest is actually two of our guests have been nominated. We've got an ambassador coming on later, and they'll be interested in coming to all the seminars as they can.
Yes. Yes, it's going to be a great event, and these seminars are free, listeners. So, you know, feel free to if you're in the Costa Mesa, California area on June 22nd. Well, actually, yeah, June 22nd, because it's on Friday and Saturday, so the 21st and 22nd. Feel free to come by, say hi to some great names in martial arts, take some seminars. It's going to be a fun time.
Sifu, they do have to buy a banquet ticket for those seminars to be available.
Oh, that's right. So, yeah. So you can't just walk through the doors and like, oh, hey, I'm going to take a seminar with, you know, with Mr. Shui. It's not like that. You actually have to be ticketed. Is that a verb? Ticketed?
I don't know. You make up so many words as you go along. I never know anymore.
I don't know. So you actually have to have a banquet ticket to show that you're actually attending the Masters Hall of Fame event. That way it actually, you know, keeps the the people just coming in off of the street and stuff like that. So it'll keep everything on a nice even keel. But it's going to be great seminars, and all through this month and through the first part of June, we're going to have as many of the nominees on our show as guests as we can, and ambassadors also. And we've got two great guests coming on. I just want to let our listeners know that after we talk to our first guest, we've got Professor Terry Faircloth that's going to be with us at around the 6:40 Pacific time slot. So, Sifu Faircloth, if you're listening, I'll give you a call at around that time. But let's go ahead and get on with the show, because I'm pretty excited about our guests tonight. What do you think, Bob? Okay.
I am too. It's going to be a great show, and the first time we've ever tried this format.
Yeah, this is going to be great, where we've had multiple guests where it wasn't a forum type show. This is going to be
right.
This is going to be great. So our first guest coming up right now began his training in Kempo Karate in 1970. And in 1972, began training directly under Gary Swan, the president of the National Chinese Kempo Association. The NCKKA was the first Kempo Association to separate from the IKKA with Mr. Ed Parker's blessing. And eventually, our guest, Mr. Brian Duffy, became its vice president in 1978. And since 1972, Mr. Duffy has competed in over 124 tournaments and has won over 157 trophies. Also in 1987, Sifu Duffy began studying directly under Mr. Ed Parker and later joined the IKKA. In 1989, Mr. Parker promoted Mr. Duffy to fifth-degree black belt and began involving Mr. Duffy in projects for the IKKA, such as the development of standardized children's curriculums and revisions of the IKKA belt charts and manuals. He is the owner and operator of Brian Duffy's Kempo Karate in Austin, Texas, which is the headquarters of the American Kempo Federation. So it is me and Sifu Roberts' honor and pleasure to welcome Master Brian Duffy to the show. Welcome, Sifu Duffy.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to talk with you guys.
Thanks for joining us. Wow. Now, 1970, that was like when I was like 4 years old. That was even before I...
Okay, thanks a lot. All right, we're starting off on a real good footing here. Are you saying that I'm older than dirt? Is that it?
It's me and Sifu's Bob's signature to always date ourselves. So
right.
No, actually, it was more along the terms of respect, because a lot of people do get into the martial arts and then maybe after 10 years of experience start calling themselves master, whereas, you know, you've put in the sweat, you've put in the toil for a very long time, and your title of professor in Sifu is earned, and that I respect dearly. And so that was kind of the approach I was getting at.
Yeah, good save.
You like that save, Bob? You like
that? Oh, yeah.
I liked it, too.
You safe at home.
Good. I think I fooled everybody. No. So, you know, with that was like the golden age of martial arts, so to speak. I mean, like Bruce Lee was starting to get very popular.
The Bruce Lee pictures going on,
The Kung Fu
series was on. There were martial arts schools that were opening up right and left. It was the boom period.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated high school in 1970, and when I went down to register for college, I passed a karate school, and after registering for classes with college, I stopped in there and signed up for some classes in the martial arts, and been doing it ever since. Started at a real, you know, like I say, the kind of the golden age. It was a, you know, boom area or boom period at that point in time. And I trained for about 3 years. And after about 3 years, my instructor, Mr. Swan, was opening a branch location here in Austin. Like I said, schools were opening quite a bit because the interest was so high then. And I took a job. And this was San Antonio where I was training originally. That's where I grew up. And I took a job here in Austin managing a studio for him, and I managed it for him for about 3 years, and then I bought it from him, and it's been in operation ever since. You know, so it's been a great ride.
Very cool.
Very cool. And you gotta respect individuals, Sifu, that grew up with no safety gear when they spart.
For real, right?
It was all, yeah. All bare knuckle. You were lucky to have cups back then.
Yep. We had the old style cups, the flat cups. You didn't have the tuck under cups.
Oh yeah.
For a long time, and they were not quite as protective. I can just say that much.
No, that's just a barrier. What does it do a thing?
Yeah, I remember when safety gear first came out. We used to always fight. You know, you just tape your feet, and tape your hands, and fight, and then safety gear came out. I have a funny story. A friend of mine is Ray McCallum, who's very well known, and his teacher was Demetrius Ivanis, who was one of the legends here in Texas karate. And so when safety gear came out, the story goes that Demetrius put on a pair of gloves, pulled one of his students over, and said, "Let me see this," hit him right in the head. Then he held up his hand and said, "That's great, didn't hurt my hand at all."
That reminds me, like when I was a kid, we used to have these foam knuckle covers. So they kind of looked like the modern MMA gloves that we have today, but they were just made out of foam. And you know how like foam back then was, you know, when it got old, you know, encrusted or whatever, it would get hard, and then it would start to just kind of wear away, right? And it got to a point where everybody's foam would just wear away on the knuckles. And there was still foam on the back of your hand and still foam on the front of your fingers, but the knuckles, there was no foam. So, you know, we would put on these things with this false sense of security, like, okay, this isn't going to hurt my hand. But we would always manage to make contact with somebody's forehead.
Yeah.
And we were like, these things are good for nothing. It's better to just go without. And
right.
But, yeah, I think those were the days because that was when control of technique was paramount. Nowadays you've got like the bullet sparring gloves with an extra 4 inches on the end, and and it just gives people a false sense of security. Look at us, we're talking about old school training. This is awesome.
Well, these youngsters coming up, Steve, who have to know what these guys went through.
Exactly.
They had their teeth knocked out. They had their pans broke.
Right. Exactly. And
well, they had their junk kicked.
Well, I'm just glad this isn't a television show, or you'd see the crookedness of my nose and realize that sometimes it wasn't so forgiving.
Yeah. Well, this is actually a great segue into what I wanted to ask next, you know, considering it was like the golden age of martial arts. And it was Kenpo, and it would be considered old school training back then. What was it like training in your school under Master Swan and under Mr. Parker during that time?
You know, I've been blessed with excellent teachers. You know, I have a wonderful history. Mr. Swan was an excellent instructor. He came out of Steve LeBounty School.
Mm-hmm.
And LeBounty School produced himself, who was one of the top Kenpo practitioners. Tom Kelly was Steve LeBounty's student. Huck Plantis was Steve LeBounty's student originally. So, I mean, there's just the lineage that I have, I've been blessed with, and I can't ask for anything, you know, better. And I've been blessed over the years to associate myself with some very quality martial artists. You know, Mr. White, who's an ambassador to the Masters Hall of Fame, been associated with him for the last, you know, 20 years. And but getting back to the training, I mean, the training was very rigorous. I mean, we did a lot of calisthenics. We did a lot of, you know, body toughening exercises to, you know, condition your forearms and your shins and your knuckles, and a lot of sparring, a lot of, you know, technique. self-defense technique lines, and it was good stuff. Loved it.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Now, for our listeners out there that aren't familiar with Kenpo, American Kenpo, would it be possible for you to give our listeners just kind of like a brief history of American Kenpo as it is here in the United States at the moment?
The American Kenpo system was developed by Mr. Parker, Edmund Parker, mm-hmm. Who was a student of William Chow mm-hmm. in Hawaii. And Mr. Chow had two main influences in his martial arts. He was a Hawaiian Chinese lineage, and he learned a Shaolin-based art through his from his father. Mm-hmm. And then he also cross-trained with James Potosi and learned a hard style Kenpo system, Koshiru Kenpo, from James Potosi. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that Mr. Parker credits him with the blending of the linear from the Koshiru and the circular from the Shaolin base to give the combination of linear and circular that's found in our system. I asked Mr. Parker at one point in time, I said, how much of what we're doing now is what you learned from Mr. Chow, and how much is it of your own, you know, developments that you've done since then? And he said that what we were doing now was about 20% is what he learned from Mr. Chow. The rest he continued to develop. Mm-hmm. Mr. Parker was a extremely analytical, extremely intelligent person. If you've ever seen his books, Infinite Insights,
mm-hmm.
The spectrum that he covers, the way he analyzes things, he just had a very astute mind and a very inquisitive mind. And he continued to develop his system, you know, all the way through his lifetime. Left a legacy for us, but also left us, you know, a series of, it's a scientific art. The thing that Mr. Parker didn't want to happen was when he died to have his art die with him. Mm-hmm. So he based his art on principles and concepts. And he used to say that if you look at other scientific disciplines like medicine or engineering, things like that, as the years and centuries progress, the knowledge base gets bigger and bigger. He says you look at some martial arts, and the farther away you get from the source, it gets more and more watered down, and you lose things. And he didn't want that to happen with his system. So he based the system on principles and concepts and logic, and so that the system could continue to grow, and it has. I mean, it's being practiced all over the world now, and I've been fortunate enough to go to Ireland and England and see the art practice there, and it's being carried on with great success. I have a small group in Chile, and I'm supposed to say hello to all my group in Chile because they're listening on the internet now.
Awesome.
They knew I was going to be on the show. But I have a group in Chile, so I've been able to go over to Chile and see the martial arts practice there. And Mr. Parker was very successful in the way that he put his art together so that it could continue past his death. He's been dead he's been gone now for over 20 years, and his system continues to expand and flourish. So, I mean, the things that he tried to do in his lifetime were very successful.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Very cool. Now, for our listeners out there that might be wondering, what would you consider some of Kenpo's, how should we say, signatures, signature techniques, so to speak, or signature flavors?
Well, it's primarily a hand-oriented system. Mm-hmm. Works about 60, you know, percent hands or more. Tends to work in close. Uses combinations instead of single strikes. And characterized by the use of, like I say, linear and circular
mm-hmm.
movements. So, I think the thing that everybody thinks about when they think of Kenpo is, you know, the self-defense techniques. And mm-hmm. The techniques are sometimes have been criticized for being overkill. You know, that if you ever did a technique, you know, the way it's taught to us, if you ever did a technique like that on somebody, I mean, they'd be dead way before you could finish the technique. And Mr. Parker, you know, said that it's not that it's that we're trying to produce overkill. He wanted his people to be overskilled, is what he said.
And the
multiple strikes are designed so that if one strike is not effective, that you just go to the next strike and you continue until the job is done. But, you know, the technique could be as short as, you know, a single strike, but you don't expect it to be that short. You have combinations and you have follow-ups and you're always looking for your next opening. You're looking for the next target. You're setting the guy up for the next strike so that if the first one doesn't work, then you have something in mind. There's not that moment of hesitation where you're looking and trying to figure out what to do next. The guy pops you and you're on the downside then.
Right. And that's what I thought was really, what I've always thought was really great about the science of Kenpo that Mr. Parker had put together. Because, you know, when I was a kid, I'd heard that too. Oh, it's overkill and stuff like that. But I really like the way that you put it, overskilled, and that, you know, it's not necessarily that you're dealing with one person. You could be dealing with multiple, and you just happen to have that flow that you've learned through overkill. And it's a wonderful, wonderful signature. It's awesome. So for people out there that think Kenpo is overkill, there's a reason. There's a reason why it's like that. So Sifu, Bob, do you have...
Let me say just one thing. What's interesting is... you know, Mr. Parker did some movies years ago, and he did one with, I think it was Bong Soo-han was opposite him, and Mr. Parker played the bad guy, obviously. I think the name of the movie was Kill the Gold Goose, but in one of the scenes, there Bong Soo-han is in the morgue, and he's looking at all these bodies that Mr. Parker has gone through, and he says, "Oh yeah, this is the signature move right here. Massive overkill."
I did not know
that's
that.
Cool.
That is cool. See, now I'm gonna have to like find that movie on Netflix or something. That's awesome. Hey, Sifu Bob, do you have any questions? I'm just
curious. Sifu Brian, I'm really curious. It says in your bio online that after you reached your fifth degree, you were given certain tasks. You were given projects, including developing a children's curriculum.
Yes.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but I also want to find out, what is the difference when you started, and of course you started when you were, you know, older than most start as of today. They start when you're in the 4, 5, 6, 10. You start when you're 18. But what is the difference now between a kid's curriculum now and when you started?
Well, when I started, there really weren't that many children involved. It was mostly a young man's art. When you went to a studio, you saw a lot of, you know, guys that were in college or early 20s. There were not as many women involved back then. There was not as many children, although, you know, we had kids' classes, but they just weren't the prevalent. You know, most commercial karate schools now make their living off of their children's programs.
Of course.
But back in those days, that wasn't the case. It was mostly an adult-oriented environment. So people had children's curriculums. I mean, for years I had not really a children's curriculum. We had the same curriculum for the kids as we did for the adults, you know, until we finally figured out that, well, you know, this is not really working that well. We need to have something that's a little bit different. The problem with a lot of the children's curriculums that you find is that they tend to leave certain things out. Obviously, you have to reduce the amount of requirements for a kid so that they can feel the, you know, positive reinforcement of being able to achieve success in the art. But if you don't have a system to where they can recoup that knowledge, then when they move into the adult program, when they get older than the kids' class and they move into the adult program, there's a problem because kids tend to be they tend to get discouraged because there's so much that they have to now make up to be able to continue into the adult program. So when I set my children's program up, I set it up so that, it just spread the material out for a longer period, and then there's whenever a child gets older than the kids program, they can shift into the adult program, and then they just assume the belt of that level. So they continue, you know, now they get adult belts instead of kids belts, but there's nothing that they have to go back and make up. They just continue on the curriculum, moving into the adult requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, very cool. Now, when do your kids become old enough to become adult into the adult program? When they're 16, or when is that?
You know, it really depends upon the child. I'll let them get into the adult classes somewhere anywhere from junior high on up, and my reasoning for that is when a kid goes into junior high, and he's going to have to worry about, say he's just starting junior high at a 6th or 7th grade, he's going to have to worry about, you know, kids who are older than him picking on him, and he having to defend himself against someone older and larger. If he's the oldest kid in the kids' class, he's never being challenged by anybody small or anybody larger than he is. Mostly all the rest of them are younger than him. So by moving him into the adult class, then they go ahead and they have to deal with, you know, adult size individuals, and they're working back and forth, and they get more used to someone bigger being able to, you know, defend themselves against that type of individual. So I'll move them in anywhere from junior high on up. And it depends as well upon if there's a child who's in junior high, but he has siblings in the kids class still, and it's more convenient for the parents to keep him in the kids class, then we can do that for a while too. And sometimes if the kid's a little bit younger, but he's got a dad or a mom in the adult class, and they want to, you know, make their schedule a little bit easier, we try to accommodate them and put them in the adult class as well. If they have an older sibling or a parent in the class, it makes it a lot easier for them anyway. Mm-hmm. They're working with someone in the family.
Right.
Now, you know, I'm looking at your bio, and it says you restructured the 16 technique curriculum. What is that in Kempa?
The curriculum, when I moved into the IKKA from the NCKKA, I started studying Mr. Parker's updated curriculum, and really liked the information that I found there. In fact, that was one of the prime reasons of leaving Mr. Swan, who was my instructor for, you know, 15 years, and I had a great loyalty to him. But the curriculum that we had in the NCKKA was missing some things, missing the updated developments that Mr. Parker had continued to develop and employ. So I got into the IKKA and started working with that curriculum and really liked the material. However, I just thought that the structure had a little bit too much of what I call a front-end load. The first belt, the yellow belt, had 10 self-defense techniques required on it, and then the next rank had 24, had 2.5 times as much material, and then 24 for every rank from that point on. So I spoke to Mr. Parker, and I said, you know, I love your system, but I think that it could be structured to be a little bit more effectively introduced. And I came up with the 16 technique curriculum, which in Kempo we have what are called base techniques and extensions. And in the 24 technique curriculum, the base techniques are introduced through the rank of second brown, and then you get extensions to the techniques in first brown, first black, second black, and third black. When I restructured the curriculum, I set it up to where the first rank, yellow, still had 10. But then for the next four ranks, orange, purple, blue, and green, there were 16 techniques required. And then for the next four ranks, which was third brown, second brown, first brown, and first black, there were 20 techniques required, which gave you your base techniques at first black instead of second brown. And then the extensions are done for second black, third black, fourth black, and fifth black. So it just spread the material a little bit longer and made it a little bit more of a stair-stepped approach. Instead of having the first rank 10 techniques and then every rank after that 24, You have the first rank, 10 techniques, the next four ranks, 16 techniques, the next four ranks, 20 techniques, and then you deal with extensions after that. And it's worked very well for myself. Mr. Parker looked at it, analyzed it, liked what I had done, and gave me his blessing to use it. He also sent the curriculum out to other schools. In fact, one of my friends, John Sepulveda, who's a Masters Hall of Fame alumni, I met him after Mr. Parker's death. He and I both became regional directors for the IKKA for our respective regions, me in the Southwest around Texas and Mr. Sepulveda in the Northern California area. And we started communicating, and I went out and did a seminar at his school. He came out and did a seminar at mine. When he came out, the first time to do a seminar for me, he said, "Hey, have you seen this?" And it was an orange belt manual with my 16 technique curriculum on it. And said, "Yeah." I said, "I wrote it." He said, "What?" I wrote that curriculum. He goes, "Oh, Mr. Parker gave this to me." He said, "Yeah, I know he gave it to you." And so I pulled out my original letters to Mr. Parker, my original restructuring and everything, and showed it to him. He goes, "Well, this is great. I mean, we love this." He said, we've been looking for something like this for a long time. So Mr. Sepulveda, all of his guys use it as well. And I know there are some other people that Mr. Parker sent it to, because whenever he had an idea, he always would test drive it with various different people, people around the country. He'd throw that idea out and see how other people liked it as well. He'd try to get the one thing that Mr. Parker was very, very, one of his greatest attributes was utilizing the assets and talents of those people in his organization. And he would get feedback from other people on ideas as well. As I said, Mr. Sepulveda has been using that curriculum. His student, Ed Downey, from Ireland, who I think is a Masters Hall of Fame alumni as well, I think they have something like 30 or 40 schools in the European area. They all use that curriculum. So, I mean, it's very rewarding to me, and just confirms that, that what I did was something that was needed by, at least some people felt it was needed. And it has been very well received, and just gives me, kind of confirmation that my idea had some validity to it.
Oh, very cool, Seafood. Now, tell us about your Texas training camp. Is that still going on? I know you started in 94.
Yes. One of the when I was in the NCKKA, one of the things that the NCKKA did that was kind of different from a lot of groups is they would have outdoor training camps. I was my first training camp in the NCKKA was in the first Texas training camp was in the spring of 1974, and they did an annual training camp in Texas. They did a training camp. They had schools in Arizona, and they did a training camp in Arizona. I attended those training camps a lot of times. They had a group in Northern California under Mr. LeBounty, and they had their own training camp as well. And it was like I say, kind of unique. I mean, that organization was doing this type of training before. Maybe other organizations were doing it, and I just were not exposed to it. But any of my friends that I talked to, that and other people in martial arts, it seemed like we were the only guys doing that. Well, after I left the NCKKA and I started working with Mr. Parker, I wanted to continue that tradition with my group. So we started doing training camps again. And my first one it wasn't 94. My first one was actually in about 91, I think, that we did. The first one that we did. And I think I had John Sepulveda out for that one, actually. And Tom Kelly and myself were the instructors. And so I've been doing an annual training camp for my group since then. And we have it every year in October on the weekend of Columbus Day, because 17 years ago, I quit doing martial arts professionally full-time, and I took a job with the Postal Service. I'm a mailman during the day. So I do the training camp on the weekend of Columbus Day, because that way after the camp's over, Columbus Day is a holiday, and I get a day to rest before I have to go back to work.
Awesome.
That is so cool.
That is.
Now, Sifu, have you kept pretty traditional, because you've been around a long time and studied Kenpo exclusively almost, it sounds like. Have you kept true to the art, or have you developed other ways other than the curriculum-based to do things? Because most arts go through a renaissance period where it's a rebirth, a revamping, developing new things. Have you gone through that kind of thing with your groups?
Oh, sure. We're always trying to keep things fresh. I mean, we teach the traditional American Kenpo curriculum, like I said, and we do all the numbered forms and the sets and all the self defense techniques. But we're doing some work with developing a ground fighting curriculum. The prevalence of MMA in the arts these days leads to the fact that there's much more people that are doing groundwork, and your likelihood of coming up against somebody in the street who's had some ground training is higher now than it used to be years ago. So
right.
Just having some skills as to how to protect yourself on the ground, the thing that we're trying to do in that respect is we're not trying to become ground fighters, but we want to be able to have a skill set so that we can defend ourselves on the ground and get ourselves back on our feet and play our game, which is a stand-up fighting game. I also do some work. I've developed some. I developed a staff curriculum for the that's based upon the Kenpo self defense techniques. I've got a couple of staff forms that I've developed. Well, actually, three different staff forms that I developed in a series of staff versus staff self defense techniques that I've developed as well, and a few things like that.
That's
very
awesome.
Cool.
That is
very,
very
cool.
Very cool. You know, we're big. The Masters Hall of Fame is a huge supporter of Bob White and his Royal Kids Camp, and all of course be with his wife when she's teaching the seminar because she needs people to thump on. since our segment is just about over, Sifu, what do you feel? Well, a couple questions. One, how did you feel getting inducted into the Hall of Fame? And two, what do you think the future holds for Sifu Brian Duffy?
Well, concerning getting inducted into the Hall of Fame, I mean, it's an honor. It gives, any type of validation from your peers for the work that you've done over the years is always very rewarding. And I'm very honored and humbled to be, part of this prestigious group, to tell you the truth. For myself, I'm going to continue teaching the art. We're still, like I say, working and developing different projects. I've been in the art now for 43 years. It's just something that is part of me. And I have my small... president of the American Kenpo Federation. We have schools in Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, New Mexico. I have my group in Chile, and I'm 60 years old now, and so I'm trying to just like Mr. Parker did, where he wants to leave something for generations to continue after him. I want to do the same with my group. I want to get them, the skill sets they need to, if something ever happens to me, you never can't tell. You get hit by a bus next week. If I want them to have the skill set so that if I'm, not here, that they can continue on and they can be successful martial artists as well.
Those are great words to apply. Absolutely. Well, Sifu, in reference to today, Sifu, Rusty, and I really want to thank you. This was a great segment.
Mm-hmm.
And both of us, and I'm sure, and I can speak for Rusty, and
yep.
We both look forward to meeting you.
Yes.
And I want to sit down. You know, there's going to be, when are you coming into the Masters, Friday or Saturday?
I'm coming in Friday.
Oh,
great.
Cool.
You know, we're having a VIP reception in the bar on Friday night at the Hilton.
Okay.
For all of us to meet and hang out and exchange pleasantries. And we really look forward, and I hope you can make all the seminars when you get there. Absolutely.
I'm going to try to.
What do you feel, Sifu Rusty?
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely look forward to meeting you, Sifu Brian. In advance, Sifu Bob and I would like to congratulate you as a nominee and a future inductee, like only in a month, to the Masters Hall of Fame. And we're very, very happy to have you as part of our organization.
Well, thank you very much. I look forward to meeting you too. It's been a pleasure talking to you both. And I think that the organization and the work you guys do is great.
Oh, beautiful.
Thank you
so much, Sifu.
All righty. Thank you so much, Sifu Brian.
Pleasure talking to you.
You too, sir.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right. That was Sifu Brian Duffy. I can't even talk now. Sifu Brian Duffy.
I heard that you almost called him Sifu Bot.
Yeah, I almost
did. But you corrected yourself. And nobody would have known if I hadn't brought that up.
Now you're just like giving me a hard time for bringing up stuff last week.
Right.
All right. So our phone number here is 347-677-0699. Let's go ahead and take a quick PSA break and stay tuned, everyone. Our next guest is going to be Professor Terry Faircloth of the Faircloth Method of Kajikambo. We'll be right back after this. And while you guys are listening to our PSAs, I'm going to give Professor Faircloth a call. So we'll be right back after this.
This is Nnamdi Asamoah. I play football for the Philadelphia Eagles, but what I do off the field with United Way might be more important. I'm a volunteer tutor and mentor. Why? Because over a million kids a year drop out of school, and that's not okay. It takes 12 years to create a graduate, but it takes about the same time to create a dropout. And the difference between a child becoming one or the other could be me, or it could be you. Studies show that if we get to these kids earlier, their chances are better, and kids who read well by third grade are more likely to graduate. So join me in United Way. Suit up and take the pledge. Become a volunteer reader, tutor, or mentor. Because when a child succeeds, we all succeed. Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Take the pledge at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way, the Ad Council, and the National Football League.
This is Annie Lennox of Eurythmics. Or RAD. Please don't drink and drive, and don't drive if someone else has been drinking. Thank you.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
Today in school, I learned a lot. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes me. In English, I learned that I'm disgusting. And in physics, I learned that I'm a loser.
Today in school, I learned that I'm ugly and useless. And in gym, I learned that I'm pathetic and a joke. In history, I learned that I'm trash.
Today in school, I learned that I have no friends. In English, I learned that I make people sick. And at lunch, I learned that I sit on my own because I smell. In chemistry, I learned that no one likes
me. In biology, I learned that I'm fat and stupid. And in math, I learned that I'm trash.
The
only thing I didn't learn is why no one ever helps.
Kids witness bullying every day. They want to help, but they don't know how. Teach them how to stop bullying and be more than a bystander at stopbullying.gov. A message from the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Eddie Morales from Kicking It Old School on KCAA 1050 AM. I want to take this opportunity to invite you to the martial arts event of the year, the Masters Hall of Fame, on Saturday, June 22nd, 2013, at the Orange County Hilton, located in Costa Mesa, California. This year's theme is Women in the Martial Arts. Our guest speaker will be Lisa the Black Widow King. We will be honoring many legends in the martial arts. Join Dan and I from Kicking It Old School at the Masters Hall of Fame, Saturday, June 22nd, 2013. Get your tickets now at mastershalloffame.org.
And now, on with the show.
All right, and we are back. If you are just now tuning in, this is the Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio Show with Rasita and Robert. Our phone number here is 347-677-0699. So feel free to call in at any time to ask questions with our upcoming guests. We also have a chat board under the Blog Talk Radio show marquee. So if you're listening live through Blog Talk Radio, just scroll down a little bit and you'll see a little flash chat board down there. And if you don't want to call in or you're too chicken to call in, you can go ahead and type your questions there. I'd like to, it's my honor to actually introduce our next guest. Our previous guest was Sifu Brian Duffy of Kempo. And I'd like to bring on a guest from Kajukenbo. One of my previous teachers, and I'm really honored to bring this next guest onto our show tonight. So our guest for our second segment today is the founder of the Faircloth Method within the Kajukenbo system. He's currently an 8th-degree black belt and considered a professor in the art, and has contributed to my own journey in the martial arts as my instructor in the Faircloth Method. So it's my honor and Sifu Robert Deal's honor and pleasure to welcome Professor Terry Faircloth to the show. Welcome, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you. It's
awesome.
Really good to hear you.
It's good to hear from you, too. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us. So if we've got anyone out there that would like to speak to Professor Faircloth, please call in 347-677-0699. We've also got Sifu Bob with us. Say hi, Sifu Bob.
Good Hello. Afternoon, Professor.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you, too. I love your show.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, sir. We appreciate that.
Thank you. Now, Sifu Bob, I was talking to Professor just a little bit ago, and, you know, because I wanted to keep everything, you know, within, you know, good Wu-Tei and stuff like that, I was like, so Sifu, do I call you Professor or Sifu? Does it matter? Professor goes, just Sifu. And I'm like, okay, cool, because it's you know, it's got too many syllables, and Professor, it's got too many syllables, and my brain isn't working today, just like it was yesterday, because I have to admit to everybody, because Sifu Faircloth like figured it out first. Yesterday I was trying to edit the show marquee, and I completely misspelled Sijo. I put an I on the end, and Sifu Faircloth like emailed me and goes, "Man, girl, lay off the coffee, because now you can't type. First you can't talk, and now you can't type." And I'm like, "Oh man!" And I was. It was like it was one of those weeks.
Wow,
but
that's four letters. Four lousy letters.
I know, but if I missed the home row on my keyboard, that's going to be my
excuse. What?
The home row, you know, the
row.
Oh,
that's not,
yeah.
That's not what I thought you said.
Dude.
I'm sorry.
Oh, God. So, as our listeners can already tell, we like to have fun on this show. We're not one of those, you know, uber serious, you know, you know, stick in the mud type of shows, and I know Sifu Faircloth, you'd enjoy the show. It's like we love to have fun here. It's like it's a blast. So what Sifu Bob and I like to do for all of our guests is we kind of like to turn back the clock a little bit and see what our guests' beginnings in the martial art is like. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about what got you interested into martial arts, and very importantly, what got you interested in Kaju Kenbo?
Actually, a friend of mine came by and he said, "Sir Clark, you got to go see this movie with me." Mm-hmm. And so it was a Chuck Norris movie, Good Guys Wear Black, and we went mm-hmm. and saw it. And the next day, we were out searching for school. And,
right on.
Yeah, it was, you know, never even dreamed of doing martial arts. And we went to a couple schools, and they were all, you know, I didn't know nothing about martial arts. But then we went to this little basement school, and I was watching this man do incredible things. And he came out to talk to us. His name was Sifu Joe Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember sitting there in a chair. He was sitting on the desk, on his desk. My friend Danny was sitting on his desk also, mm-hmm. on the other opposite end. And I was across from him in the chair. And I said, "Well, what would you do if we attacked you right now?" And I'll never forget this. He, without blinking, his eyes were still on me. He reached over quickly and just tapped Danny in the throat and said he'd be dead and you wouldn't get out of the chair. And it caught me off guard, and I wanted in right then. I had no clue it was Kaju Kenbo or anything. I just saw what he did, and that was my first day, and it was awesome.
Very cool.
Training was difficult, but I was going to quit all the time, but I never did quit. But I was going to quit.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, when they, at least a martial artist, not necessarily, you know, people that don't know anything about martial artists, when they hear the word Kaju Kenbo, it almost seems like every martial artist that I've met, even people that have done karate or even, you know, traditional kung fu, they go, "Oh my gosh, Kaju Kenbo," right? So, you know, there's a reputation for Kaju Kenbo being very tough, very old school, I guess, in a way. Can you tell us a little bit about your training under Sifu Clark and your other instructors? Because I'd love for our listeners to hear about the old school. Me and Bob are about old school. We love the old school.
Sifu Clark was an incredible man. He had studied. He took his Kaju Kenbo, he studied from Ogong Tony Ramos,
mm-hmm.
And he went ahead and studied 6 years of Northern Shaolin, and he studied 3 years of advanced, Wing Chun from Bruce's student Daniel Lee, and then he studied 6 years of Fa Kwa from Pong on Orcas Island, and he incorporated that into his Kaju Kenbo, which in turn softened it up to a little bit, got more gung fu and related, you know, as far as our movement goes.
Mm-hmm.
Sifu Clark was a stickler when it came to clean technique, and if it wasn't clean, he'd let you know. I always thought he hated me. you know, I always thought he hated me, but he didn't. It was just his way of teaching. And I can remember my third day in class. We didn't have structure classes. You just came in when you came in, and you went over in your corner, and you started what you were doing last, and then he'd come over and help you here and there. I never heard anything about Sifu. We call him Sifu. So my third day in class, I'm doing something, and I look across the room, and I said, "Hey, Joe, was it like this?" And he walked over and thumped me pretty good on the top of my head, and explained to me that, you know, the correct way to address him. And that was his part.
A stickler for form, stickler for etiquette. That's awesome.
incredible teacher. I training was hard. It was a lot of fundamentals, a lot of fundamentals as far as like clean technique and reverses and lunges and et cetera. and when it came to self-defense, it was difficult at first for me. We're, you know, doing a lot of technique within technique, meaning, you know, from Kaji Kimbo, where you, guy, for instance, grabs you from behind and you slide back in a horse stance and strike his eyes, and then you revert, you lock his arm, and you reverse, and then you turn around and reverse back, and that was and hit him in the throat, and that was difficult for me because I was like the ugly duckling that I always believed in class. But what was nice about Kaji Kimbo was that you could, sooner or later, you get to start developing your own way of moving from it. And that was the benefit of it. You know, unfortunately, I only had Cecil Clark for like 3 years, and then he ended up moving to Florida, and one of his top students, Sifu Rick Winkle, took over as a fill-in for the next 13 months. And that was a blessing in disguise. We were all afraid of Sifu Winkle. He trained every day for 2 years. His last 2 years, every single day, 10 hours a day with Sifu Clark, like a shadow. And I saw him explode 8 bricks, you know, with blood coming off his knuckles.
Wow.
Incredible skill level with Sifu Winkle. And he allowed me to begin changing my street application to suit me. I will always be grateful for that because it excelled me from being stuck on doing a certain way. I could do it my own way. And that was a big benefit. And then Stephen Clark ended up coming back 13 months later, and I earned my black belt from Sifu Winkle, and then Sifu Clark came back 6 months after that period and promoted me himself to first degree, so that enabled me that I could teach. Yeah, and the day that happened, Sifu Winkle had other plans in life, and he shook my hand and said, "It's all yours." And I was like, "What?"
Wow.
And yeah, he left, and I was left running the school.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, it was
yeah,
scary.
Wow.
It was scary.
Wow.
But you know, I haven't seen Sifu Winkle very much after that. A couple times, maybe. He went into his own business, and but that was the beginning of my becoming a teacher.
Wow.
And I started liking it. I remember the first time I Sifu Winkle was busy with somebody in the office, so I lined up the students for class to start. Because Sifu Winkle, he structured classes. I can remember being scared to death walking into the office and asking him, "I hope you didn't mind that I did that." And then he told me, "No, I want you to start doing that." So, but I was scared. I was scared because we're all afraid of him.
Yeah, yeah. You don't want to, you know, seem like you're stepping on toes. Like, oh, I'm going to start class, and yeah, yeah. In fact, I remember. I think I asked you the same thing one time, right? The first class that I started, I looked at my watch and I'm like, oh gosh, it's like 6:05, you know. And I think I walked into the office, or I lined them up. I'm like, well, you know, the worst that could happen is I could be put in a horse stance, right? And then I started them up and got them warmed up and okay, 100 jumping jacks. And I think I walked into the office and I said, "Sifu, I hope you didn't mind." It wasn't that I was afraid of you. It was more like, did I just mess up some type of, you know, a rule somewhere, right?
Right.
You know, because it was Sifu that started the class. It wasn't, you know, a first degree. And I was like, oh my gosh, because everyone was starting to mill around and talk, and I'm like, oh, this needs to stop. You know,
right.
I better do something. And I was scared too. You know, even after 20 years of karate, I was like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? And I just want our listeners to know, you know, the reason why I'm talking like, you know, like I know him is because I do. I want our listeners to know that, you know, Sifu Faircloth did teach me in the Faircloth method within Kajikembo. And, you know, the thing that I like about the Faircloth method is that it brought a no-nonsense approach to self-protection, but also brought in your own influences, Sifu, into the method. And like you said, it allowed people to learn the base, but also express themselves. And that was something that I was looking for after doing karate. And it, you know, it was kind of like a whew to know that, okay, you know, I can move, you know, the way that I want to, as opposed to being stuck to, you know, number one, number two, number three, number four. Right. So that's how I had learned in karate, right? But the neat thing was, listeners, listen up. The neat thing was that even though the method didn't lose the flavor of Kajikembo, if anything, it evolved in it. It evolved, you know, the Faircloth method evolved from it, and it allowed me personally to really look back at my karate and go, oh, hey. You know, this is why I did karate, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
And to be able to respect all the martial arts and stuff like that. So for that, thank you so much, Sifu. Now, speaking of methods, Sifu, as many teachers out there might know, creating a method or a system can be sort of difficult depending on the situation. Because, you know, some teachers may prefer to grow and evolve, yet still keep the base foundation and flavor of their influences. However, that can be hard. I mean, I've seen systems that are offshoots of other systems, and it sort of like loses the flavor of their base. Yet your method did not. Your method kept the original flavor of Kajikembo, but evolved through your expression, so to speak. So can you tell us about what it was like, you know, creating your own system within a system? Did you know you were creating a system?
I think a lot of it has to do with when I first had my first school, I had a good job. I was driving truck and taking lessons after, you know, every night. For 4 hours, that's how long the class was. But when I got to school, I made a decision to quit my job and go at this full time. I knew that it was a big risk because I knew nothing about business. I knew nothing about school, but I knew I needed the time to develop myself and my students. So I did. I ate air for the first 4 years.
We know how that goes.
I hate to interrupt, but I just want to mention
so that way someone doesn't hang up. Area code 951. Please stay on hold. We're going to get to your call, so you know, please don't think I'm ignoring you. Area code 951. Please stay on the line. We'll get to your call.
I know who that is because they just texted me.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry, Professor. Please go ahead. Or Sifu.
I think a lot of it was going full time, and you know, when you're doing it eight hours a day, it changes. You begin to change, and I'm not taking anything away from anybody that does it part time, because you know, I lost pretty much everything I owned, but by the fifth year, I had gained it all back because I had learned the business side. I had learned, I had tripled my skill level, and through my students, and it all started coming back. During that time period in 1983, Sifu Alvikoskas had just got back from Germany. He went back to the United States, and I wanted what he had. So I began to seek him out and bug him, and he would kind of like ignore me, you know. If I saw him, I would be doing street sets somewhere in the vicinity. And finally, he came up to me and he talked to me. And his first words were, "Your Kajikembo is strong." I wanted him to teach me, and so I started driving to a school on the weekends, and he began to teach me things, you know, and I ended up being with C4L for 16 years, and the blessing of it was he taught me what he did. He did not teach me one up and no. He taught me what he does specifically in a street situation, and then I would drill on for hours and until I had it down pat. He can move like unbelievable, awkward, unorthodox kind of, and I liked it, and so I excelled so that was my adventure. Starting into one off canoe and seeing different things, and I at 2 years later I began studying Arnis. So I was running a full time school, and I was taking Arnis 3 times a week in the afternoons, and I was studying also one off canoe. But it was not until the Arnis came in that it started changing all my street, all my self defense, the angle. You know, working angles, and it opened my eyes to a whole nother facet, you know, of the arts as far as movement goes. So I continued that for almost, 15 years. During the 88 period, I began studying Aikido. I only studied Aikido for just under 2 years. But it was enough for me to get the concept down of circles, of what circles are all about. I used to think linear art, straight in, straight back. I used to be dumb, young and dumb, I guess you'd call it. I think that's not good. That's not good. You know, it's just straight in and out. But then a friend of mine and someone who I respect dearly was Sensei Jerry Gould. And he set me aside one night and he said, well, if you take a straight punch and you let it just go forever, it'll go around the world and it becomes a circle. And I'll never forget that. And it opened my eyes, you know. So I started keeping an open mind, and all the arts are good. Every single art is good. It has something to offer people. Having full time every day, you know, you're putting in, you're putting 40, 50 hours a week in training and teaching, and that starts to add up, you know, monthly wise. You know, you're putting in 160 hours a month. That comes out to be about 2,000 hours a year compared to if I was doing it part time, it probably only come out to be about 480 hours a year because that's 4 times a week, you know, 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
So it kind of, they say that you hear this a lot as far as like, it's better to have one technique that's mastered than to have 1,000 that aren't, none of them are mastered. And that is true. It is true. When you start teaching and training all day long, every day, for year after year, things start to change. And that's how I started to develop my own street self-protection from C4L, from Arnis, from Aikido, and changing, you know, and times were changing, you know, people no longer fought like they did in the 60s and 50s, so I Kaji Kim was all about updating. That's what I always learned about it. Updating means one thing, updating. People back in the 50s and 60s, even in the early 70s, they fought like a jab, a punch, you know, this and that. Very few people threw kicks. So the system was built for those times, but it was also built to evolve. And that's where I took it. I took it to where people were coming at you a whole different way. Realm, you know, two hands, you know, they're throwing everything at you, and so
right.
So that was why I wanted to update it. You know, kind of like I look at it like protecting our country. We no longer use World War II aircraft.
Right.
We got jets now, and we got this and that. We update all the time, and that's my belief in as far as the self protection and the forms go. So I began to put it all together in a year time. I changed everything as far as the forms go, but some of the forms I left pretty similar to how I learned them, because there was no need to change them. They were good. They were perfect. Let's do that.
Yeah. Okay. I was like thinking to him, I can't think of a word.
But the other forms, there was a need to change them because our self-defense was moving in a different direction, and the forms had to move with it. So I updated the forms, and what a blessing that was, because you people that were studying took off. I mean, you guys were pretty much untouchable in competition.
What I loved, Sifu, about those forms was that it still kept the core of the original method, but like you said, now we're playing with jets instead of World War II planes, and that's hard for many instructors to do. You know, some instructors will just go out there and just change a form, and then whoop, and then all the originality, and the part of history, so to speak, gets lost.
Right.
Your method kept the history of Kajikembo and became a system within systems. And for our listeners out there, I want our listeners to know that, you know, when we say that, you know, system within a system, we're not just blowing smoke here, because the founder himself, Sijo Adriano Imperato, personally endorsed Sifu Faircloth back in, I wanted to say 1982. We're not that old. 1994. 82. Sorry, that was me in karate. My bad. Personally endorsed Sifu Faircloth's method, and said go for it. Yeah, and I was your dummy for it when you were demonstrating to Sijo, and all I remember was wind and floor, wind in the floor, just drip. And I just, okay, I better go with it. I'm going to hit the floor. And, it was really cool. And that's when Sijo said, go for it, Terry. And that was...
He leaned over to me when he called me up to sit. He told him, I thought I was going to sit in. I mean, here's this table. You remember the table?
Yeah, long table, and he asked you to sit next to him.
30 feet long. and all these grandmasters are there. And when they asked me, you know, I had no idea that I was going to be doing that. And
right.
He called me and said, I want you to show me everything you're doing from yellow to black belt. I was like, huh?
All right.
And but I did. I showed him what I was doing. And when I was done, I went over, he said, you're going to sit here. And you people were going up for your first degrees and second degrees, I believe, at that time. And he leaned over and said, you have my blessing. Keep doing what you're doing.
Very cool.
Yeah,
I remember looking over during the, I think it was, because it was, listeners, it was 8 hours of hell, okay? When you get a black belt Kajikembo, you earn the damn belt. And I looked over on the fourth hour, and you were there, sitting right next to Sijo, and I was like, what? Cool, something good going on there. Well, we have a call from area code 951. 951, thank you so much for being patient. You're on Dynamic Dojo.
Hi, Sifu, it's Dan. How are you?
Oh,
I'm wondering,
yeah.
How are you? It's good to
how
hear
are you?
Voice.
You too. Interesting. I got in halfway through. I'm at work. It's real quiet. If you hear a radio go off in the background, that's me. I just called to say I look forward to seeing you in June.
Me too. I cannot wait to meet you.
It's going to be a good event.
It's going to be an honor.
We got a bunch of my nephew is taking Kajikembo in up near San Francisco, and I don't know the instructor's name yet, but He just went up there, so I'm pretty excited. I'm going to go up there in a couple weeks.
Good.
And visit. He's a young kid. He's like 10 years old. But he's all excited about taking karate and beating his Uncle Dan. So looking forward to going up there. So pretty good stuff.
Oh,
very
my God.
Cool.
Cool. San Francisco. I wonder if that's some. I mean, I wonder if that's Oakland's not that. Not that
close. No, not
close
San Francisco.
To...
Is it? Is it San Francisco or? Yeah,
Oakland?
It's San Francisco.
Oh, is it?
It's
huh.
No, it's up near San Francisco. It's a suburb of San Francisco.
How long have you been training now?
Oh, 3 months. Just started.
Good.
He got his yellow tip on his belt.
Oh, awesome.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, he is doing well. So I'm going to go up there and I'm going to call Sixto when I'm up in the dojo when I go meet his instructor and say, hey, I want to introduce you to somebody.
Yeah.
So,
awesome.
Anyway. Well, I don't want to take a lot of time up on the radio. I'm literally on patrol and I pulled over the side to say hello. And you guys have a great show.
You.
I'll keep the radio on as long as I can. But,
all right.
Great show.
Pleasure talking.
See you later, Hanchi.
Thanks, Hanchi.
Thanks. Who else you got coming in?
We have Shihan
Dana
Abbott.
Dana, okay. Tell him I said hi.
We sure will.
All right. Talk to you guys later.
Okay. Thanks, Hanchi.
Bye-bye.
And that was Hanchi Dan Hecht, our CEO of the Masters Hall of Fame, which is what our shows for May and June are going to be all about. So for our listeners out there, 347-677-0699, we're getting ready to go to a soft break because we're almost at the end of this segment, Sifu. But my last question is, first of all, me and Sifu Bob, we'd like to welcome you to the Masters Hall of Fame organization in advance. I mean, the nomination's there, you know, you've accepted and now the formality of accepting the award is there. But I'd like to welcome you in advance to the Masters Hall of Fame. It's a great organization, and I'm sure you're really going to enjoy being a member of it. Now, can you tell our listeners who nominated you and what your reaction was to hearing about your nomination?
Okay. Professor Mike Santos nominated me. And what was funny was I didn't even know I was nominated. I read right past it and didn't register for about 2 months. And then I looked up the email again. Oh, I got another email and I what? And then it started coming through that what he was saying. I didn't get it at first. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote him an email. You me? Like me? I'm gonna, and he just said I feel you deserve it. You put a major effort into it, into your martial arts all these years, and I felt I felt good. Like your last guest said, mm-hmm. All your work, it felt good to be honored for it. And I'm still in shock about it. Humbled. My first reaction actually was I was writing a letter of thank you very much, but I don't, there's probably other people out there that are more worthy than me. And my girlfriend came home and said, are you kidding?
I probably would have emailed you too. What are you doing? No, it's a well-deserved nomination. And I'm glad you're now a member of the Masters Hall of Fame, and I look forward to seeing you in June, and I'm sure I'll speak for Sifu Bob, looking forward to seeing you in June, and we hope you can make it. Are you coming in on Friday or Saturday?
Friday.
Oh, okay, good, because there is that, there's a like a cocktail social or something like that at the Hilton the night before, Friday night. So it'll be a chance for everyone to get together, see each other in person, you know.
It's been a long time since I've seen you.
It's been a long time, Sifu. It's been a long time.
I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you like you wouldn't believe.
Thank you.
You've done
thank
so
you.
Well.
That means a lot. Thank you so much. All right. Well, thank you so much, Sifu, for joining us. I'm sure I'll be seeing you on Facebook, because I normally send thank yous to everyone after our shows and stuff like that. And thank you, Haunchy Dan, for calling in and saying hello. Bob, do you have any last-minute questions or comments for Sifu Faircloth?
No, Sifu, I've heard nothing but great things about you. Even I've talked to Sifu Rusty, and she told me what a genius you are when it comes to your martial arts ability and your teaching ability. I really look forward to seeing you next month and actually putting a face to the voice now and shaking your hand when we meet.
I appreciate that very much, and I look forward to it too.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you again soon.
You're most welcome.
Have a perfect day.
Take care.
I will. Thank you. Thank you for calling. Or I called him.
Yes, you did. The mic only picked up the ring and him saying hello.
Really? It did that? Oh, criminy.
Yes.
It's not supposed to do that. I need to talk to Blog Talk Radio about that, because that's not good. So.
Yeah.
Well, I think for our next segment, we're just going to go ahead and call live, because it's just so much more interesting. Anyway, thank you so much, Sifu Faircloth. We'll talk to you. Bye-bye now. All right. So considering that we've only got about 4 minutes left, I do want to skip our next soft break, because that would have been a four-minute thing. It was basically about a health news thing about how a certain sleep gene can contribute to migraines. But why don't we do this instead? Why don't we go ahead and just live call Shihan Dana Abbott, who is our next guest. What do you think,
Now,
Bob?
Also, consider this. This may not end well.
What?
We know how you are on technical difficulties.
Oh, gee. Well, it worked the last time. So we'll see what happens.
You're about due for it not to be so well.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. And we're dialing.
And it's ringing.
And it's ringing.
Let's see if Shihan picks up.
Yeah. You get to introduce
him. Oh, this is
hello.
Suck.
Hi, Shihan Dana. This is Christina calling from Dynamic Dojo Talk Radio. How are you?
Real good. How are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. I think we're going on time here. I was afraid that I was going to call you late.
Hey, well, you know how it goes.
Yeah, the radio. Sometimes the radio just gets all weird. But I want to thank you in advance for joining us in your busy schedule for our last segment.
Well, sure,
of our-
sure.
Awesome. Well, we have Sifu Bob with us, Sifu Bob Deal with us, and
Sifu
Bob,
doing?
You want to do the formalities there, Sifu Bob?
I'm good, Shihan. Listen, everybody, all our listeners, I'd like to introduce Shihan Dana Abbott. He's a very good friend of mine, alumni with the Masters Hall of Fame, and an ambassador for the association. We see him about every other year. He trades. He goes to Europe 1 year and on a seminar circuit, and then comes and shows his face at the Masters. Very good friend of mine, amazing martial arts practitioner. And somewhere in there, I'm going to dig up the story about somebody telling me he was Bill Wallace's son. Please help me welcome Shihan Dana Abbott.
Welcome, Shihan. Round of applause.
Well, you know why they thought he was my father?
Hmm.
Why is that?
Because we both walk like penguins up to our butts in the snow.
Well, do you remember the meeting that we all had for the Masters in Costa Mesa at David Dye's studio?
Yes.
I walk in the door and Shihan and Silky Greg Wilbridge nudges me, points to you and says, "That's Bill Wallace's son." And if you remember a couple of years ago, I asked you about that.
Yes.
I did Iaido for a very brief time, and that was actually a joke at our dojo. Not that you were Bill Wallace's son, but that, you know, we all walk like penguins. And,
up
you know,
our butts
we,
in snow.
Yeah, up to your butts in snow. So it's not quite a waddle. It's kind of like a... Oh, I don't know. I guess, but I know what you're talking about. Oh, that's so funny. I thought it was just a local thing that just, you know, a Seattle people walk like that.
No. You know, that's what happens.
So, Gian, we just had Hanchi Dan Hecht on, and he wanted us to convey his he wanted us to say hello.
He's actually
oh, good.
Still
well, Paul Mike said hi.
He's actually still on the line,
Hanchi Dan.
Oh, hey,
hi. How you
there?
Doing, big guy?
Hanchi Dan, are you there? Well, he was on the line, but he's probably got his mic muted.
He might be on call.
Are you guys there?
Yeah.
I've got the police rover going in the background. I didn't want you guys to have to hear one out of 12 responds to a naked man.
Nuh-uh, really?
I was sparing you the visuals. How you doing, Gian?
Real, real good. How have you been?
I've been good. I've got a funny story about your father.
Okay, you know how it goes.
So Bill and Jalen were at the USA Hall of Fame, and I go and support it. It's in Los Angeles. I go down and support Jim Thomas's event, and I sat in with Bill, and then I shoot him up a text saying, "Tell Carol I said it was good seeing her."
Yeah.
Well, it didn't go over very well. Who the hell is Carol? And so she's not real happy with me. I'm trying to tell her, look, it was a foobar on my part. My best friend's name is Bill, and his wife is Carol. I just made a mistake. She ain't buying
it. Happens.
So Bill's not water.
Nice,
awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. Well, I am going to get a radio call any second. I haven't heard anything in about a half hour, so I'm going to go back and mute and just listen to you guys speak, okay?
Okay, awesome.
Hey, well, you have a good one. Stay safe out there.
All right. Back to you, Bob.
Well, Gian, you studied many, many years in Japan. This is sort of a two-part question. Tell
sure.
us a little bit about your background, and tell us what it was like for a Caucasian to train old school in swordsmanship in Japan.
Well, it wasn't really that difficult. I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anybody. I just came over there, you know, with a whim and no money, of course. You know how that goes. But they must have saw the ambition in my eyes, or they must have seen they saw the wanna, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
And since I wanna, and they just started working with me, and just everything fell into place. A matter of fact, it fell into place so well, I'll just say that I was lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And just leave it like that, basically. But it was really, really good. First off, you know, during the rush, during the what they called the Nixon shocks, back in the early 70s, we call it the oil crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Up until then, most Americans that went over to Japan, they were like, "Oh, you're the greatest thing since the napkin." But at that time, that's how it goes, because we won the war, and since we won the war, they gave us that respect. Although we started losing it in the 70s a little bit because the governments just sort of let them go. They let them hang, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
But away from that, being over there and working with everybody and just making sure that I kept my eyes open, my mouth shut, and just was like the Energizer Bunny, everybody just accepted me. I saw no prejudice. I saw no vindictive people, anything. But the cool thing about it is my first schooling there was through the Department of Education and Recreation, you know, through university. And the sword to them at this time is made for everybody. So it wasn't like, oh, you can get into this group, but you can't go into that group. You can do this, you can't do that. It was sort of like, if it's for you, it's for everybody. So do what you like, and we'll work with you to the best of our abilities. And it was good because the guys that started Nie Tai Dai back in 1955, after MacArthur said, okay, you guys can start playing with swords and doing judo again a little bit, that just worked out really well because they were my teachers. So the ones that were starting to retire and they were like 70s and 80s, they just took me underneath their wing and said, hey, everybody bouts, buy him the beer. So it worked out really extremely well. You know, I could get into the thing like for example, if I wasn't urinating brown or blood at least three or four times a month, I wasn't putting up enough effort. And, you know, I start at 6:30, 7 in the morning, 6 days a week, and go to about 4:30 or 5. Sundays would be a tournament day. But basically, that's all you do. You eat, sleep, kendo. And the sword, for example, most of the old guys over there, it was whiskey, tobacco, kendo. Anything past that had meaningless. What about girls? Girls. No, it's whiskey, tobacco, kendo.
Nice.
But those were all the old World War II vets and all that from the Showa era. So when I learned martial arts, I learned it from the Showa era people because that was the last of what they call their old school.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really, really good that way. All I had to do was just show up and get beat up. And after 400 or 500 people, because over at the schools there, it's a little bit different. Not really, but let's look at it this way. Let's just imagine that you have a collegiate school like Arizona State University, and it's like one of the best in the country for football. And every high school captain of the football team, they're able to finally work their way up and get into that school. Well, over in Japan, it's only the size of California, and you have 125 million people who have to practice judo or kendo at junior high and high school. One of those two electives for their physical education requirements is a general rule.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, you have a lot of good people bubbling up through the years. So by the time they get over to this university, one of three in the archipelago, and that just worked in really well because I was beat up by all the hardcore people out there that were taking kendo and learning it with, you know, getting degrees and learning all the schooling so they could take it and teach it to the next generation. So not only was I beat up correctly, I was beat up in hardcore Japanese because no one spoke anything. The people that spoke, they got hit a lot. Just because you can't speak, you can ki. So basically with the nose to the grindstone and just working out all day long, this, that, and the other, just over time just sunk in. So they hit me in the head a lot.
That explains a lot, Shihan. It really does.
It does. It really, really does. So, you know, all I can say is my time over in Japan, which was about a decade and a half, was I was just constantly getting beat up by the best. And over a period of time, they had a sweat to beat me up. And then a little bit more time, I was endeared a little bit, if that makes any sense. And then I was called to what was I called? I forget the names once in a while because it's been so long. But I was basically called the bodyguard. You can hit him and he doesn't pay attention.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was pretty interesting. And the time over there and the teachers, as I said again, were real, real good. But still at that time, everybody smoked like chimneys and they drank like fish. So basically, you know, I was always in a smoke-filled room and I learned how to drink cold beer and sake. But that's where they communicate. You know, Japanese, they don't speak a lot. They're pretty much tight-lipped. They don't say a lot. But the minute they put an alcoholic beverage to their mouth, they're not responsible. Well, if, for example, back in 1962, if someone was a drunk driver, they drank a lot and they killed a whole family in the car, hey, he was drunk and, you know, it won't be bad, not like today. Well, same thing there. It's, you know, you're held accountable for whatever you say, but the minute you put a sake to your mouth, then you're not held accountable because it's a sake speaking. So... Between that and working with them, they explained to me in three-part harmony all the katas and worked with me extensively on that because they only thought I was going to be there for about a year because, hey, you're a foreigner, you're going to go back home someday. So for 15 years, they taught me like a first, second-year person, just, you know, we're going to give them as much information. So after 5 years, they go, aren't you going home? After 10 years, gee, stay away from my sister. And by 15 years, they said, you know, your English is real, real good. You should go back there because they'll understand you a lot more.
So you did assimilate to the language very well.
Oh, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
So. Pretty much. I didn't have it was a gift to gab, but the Japanese don't talk a lot. You know, there's no body language, especially in the sorting circles. So, you know, if you saw a bunch of Italians, they'd be speaking with their hands and they'd be talking around and arguing back and forth. Well, the Japanese are a little bit different. You don't see any body language unless you're drinking sake, and that's a different story. So, yeah, there's lots and lots of cool things to talk about. Just hit me with a couple of different questions and I can go off on a rant.
Cool. I got to find my questions now. Bob had some questions, and
yeah.
I lost Evernote. Sorry, Bob.
Hey, it happens.
That's okay. That's okay. Shion, did you study any other arts, or is Kendall your main style?
Oh, it was. Well, of course, anything that revolved around the sword, I worked. I started off in Kendo, and then you start learning Iaido, but you learn it with wood, a bokuto. And after you work it with wood, and then when you start working your rank in Kendo, you know, you have to fight a bunch of people, of course, like everything else, but you also have to practice what they call the Seite system. So you do so much of that. But moreover, there's another system called the Kumitachi, and it's the two-man forms. And that's where you get your first, second, third, fourth degree and stuff, because it teaches you how to interact correctly with a correct timing and speed between another opponent. And then down the road a little bit more, you start learning, you know, the finer points. So just say at the very beginning when you're using wood, it's sort of like eating mush with a wooden spoon. But after a while, you start getting a little bit more, what would we say, edumacation, and you start learning silver, and you start lifting your pinky up when you're drinking tea. And the Iaido does that. You know, real hardcore meatball, what would we say, kenjutsu is real mean, it's effective, it's practical, and it's not pretty. But when you start taking that and you start applying it to the artistic venue, then you're starting to learn how to be like, what would we, Emily Post or Mary Post, and you start learning it that way a little bit more. So by the time you're done doing that, or by the time you get a bunch of years behind you, you wear a suit well, you stand tall, you can articulate well, and moreover, you represent the spirit of the thing that still holds every Japanese close to their culture.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that makes it really, really interesting. The mindsets are completely different.
Very cool. Now, in Kendo, you start with the Seite Kata, right? What do they call it now? Is it the Zen Nippon Kendo Renmei? Did they change the name?
Zen Nippon Kendo Renmei just means All Japan Kendo Association. That's all it means.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Also study any other methods of EI?
Oh, of course. When you dealt with the people back then, I was the only foreigner around, you know, and I was one of the only foreigners that sort of spoke Japanese, and, I was there all the time. So from that aspect, excuse me, hold on for 1 second.
Okay.
I'm back. It's Mother's Day, and everybody's leaving. You know how that goes.
Oh,
oh yeah.
Oh, Where was I?
Getting into other systems of EI.
Oh, yes. So what happens is when I started dealing with a lot of these Kendo people, of course, everything's a Seite because that's through the school and the Kumitachi and all that. But you start running into a lot of World War II vets and those types of people. And then you start learning, you know, well, we have the hybrid, we have the, you know, the, what would we call it, the older systems and the newer systems. And since I was part of the Japanese Department of Education, we spent time with the Gendai or the modern systems, because I'm not 300 years old and I wasn't born into royalty over in Japan to be a samurai, you know. So no matter how hard I tried to be Japanese, you can't be Japanese because you weren't born into it. So a lot of the Iaido, even though there are a few groups of 30 or groups of 50 that practice hardcore, you know, 300-year-old, 400-year-old arts and everything like that, through the masses, you have to remember, it's 125 million people in Japan, and they all want to learn a little bit. So the, you know, Seite system works really well for the Department of Education and the Zen Nihon Kendo Renmei, but also was the Toyama Ryu. It was Toyama was the one that basically would be like their West Point. that when they, you know, mm-hmm. sent the students or the, you know, the midshipmen over there, they learned different systems, and the Toyama system worked pretty well from about 1925. Because remember, when Perry came over in what 1870s around there, you know, mm-hmm. they were getting pretty peaceful. They had that, and then when he came over, he goes, "No, we're going to sell you arms and machine guns. You've got to pick up the sword and go at it again." So what they did was, they started a system called Gunto no Soho, which means Law mm-hmm. of the Sword. And that was a five-movement kata, basically, or a five-step kata. And then from there, through, you know, the Rape of Manchuria and the Philippines and all the Korea and all that, they started putting it back in the school again. So it became Toyama, which they gave them seven katas. And then after probably 1940, I'm not a historian here, but they added the eighth kata to that. So that worked in really well. And then from there, they have a few people that did offshoots or hybrids off of that. Like my teacher's teacher, his name is Nakamura Taizaburo. And he mm-hmm. was knighted by the emperor for his sword work. And those people were really good. They were real practical. And he taught the Nakamura Ryu, which was a really good usable set from the Toyama system. Toyama mm-hmm. is a little bit more, let's say, well, this is the way my dad did it, and this is the way we did it, and we're going to combine the old and the new together. But by the time Nakamura took it over, as a general rule, it's sort of like, no, 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 you're going to cut someone, and you're going to cut him this way, you might as well use the practicality of this way, and it worked out well. And most World War II vets were pretty scared of Japanese with a sword.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's that. And, of course, you know, from the Nakamura, there's, you know, Kodachi Ai, and there's Honkihon, and there's a bunch mm-hmm. of offshoots from there. But those get meaner and meaner and meaner, you know, the more hybrid they are, as far as, you know, it isn't about pose, it isn't about this. It's about, you know, cutting and walking. 8 seconds, they drop like a sack of potatoes. If mm-hmm. you have to do any more than that, sort of like Bruce Lee, if he couldn't take someone down in 3 seconds, he'd have to train all over again. Well, remember, swording is that way. And if you lose mm-hmm. your sword, you better do something fast because your window mm-hmm. of opportunity closes. So it's really hardcore, practical application. Finger in the eye, sword to the throat, and go on to the next person. So, yeah, I didn't learn the pretty stuff. Unless it was Seitei, and then the first four katas are basically, you know, kneeling katas. And
the
then after
one,
that,
yeah.
they start, you know, standing, and they start going into the next ones. Now, when you deal with the Seitei system, you had 10 original katas.
Mm-hmm.
And then they added two more, 11 and 12. And mm-hmm. Those have a tendency to screw up with a lot of people because even though they look simple, they're very, very difficult because, for example, if you go over to kata 11, it's sort of like you've been doing rock and roll, and now you got to play jazz.
Mm-hmm.
So they take and they mix it up, and it becomes quite difficult because the timing and the rhythm is the most essential aspect of the sword. Anybody can swing the sword, but if you can do it correctly with good rhythm and timing, you'll be surprised. On you only have to be 4'8" to push out Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember learning the 11th and the 12th kata, and it completely screwed me up.
It does.
It screwed me up.
You've got to spend a lot of time on those.
It still screws me up, and yeah. I haven't done EI for like almost like 8 years, and so I'm
yeah.
really rusty and out of practice, but I remember that it just completely messed me up in comparison to the previous 10. Just bleh.
It happens. And that's what it was made for, too. It spanked a lot of people, you know. It made all those majors go back and get their ribbons, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, those are really, really good. The thing with the 11, if you want me to get into detail about that, and we can always talk about that later, is your first three strikes, you keep your elbows in, which
mm-hmm.
you don't really learn that much until you get there. You might do it with five. But, no, that's Toyama, sorry. But the other one with the Seitei on 11, which they're sort of similar. Remember, even though you have different katas from different systems and different this, you still kneel down, you still do this, you still do that. The interesting thing about it is it's sort of like learning Kung Fu in China. You know, some people do Tai Chi, some people do Hungar, some people do the monkey system, some people do this, some people do it different ways, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with a sword. it's a little bit more rigid than that. But as a general rule, some people are, you know, they're real wiry, so they can do this wiry stuff, you know, jump around on the floor in a seiza position where other people can stay down for maybe 10 minutes. But the hardest time about staying in a seiza position was during funerals, because I went to a few of those where you got to stay, you know, you don't have to move for an hour, hour and a half. So your feet are screaming to you by then.
Oh.
And that's all on wood floors or tatami mats.
Yeah. Oof.
Oh, wow. But
it's real interesting stuff. I look back now and I go, man, it was Spartan.
Mm-hmm. That's so awesome.
That is so cool.
Well, that's all I do, you know. That's all I did. I had a knack for it. And, you know, don't ask me to do math and don't ask me to do this. Don't ask me to do that. But when I put a sword in my hand, it just fits correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you have a school in Arizona, Sheena?
Pardon me?
Do you have a school in Arizona?
My job is to go around the countries and work with all the 20,000 schools. You know, I work with Century Martial Arts, and, you know, we have our product lines and all of it through there. So trying to do something nationally and internationally and stay local and working 70 to 80 hours a week, well, I've been married to the same woman for 25 years, and our kids don't have tattoos or piercings, so yeah, I had to give up something. And one of them was basically a local school to stay national. It's like this week I'm here. Hold on. We got a gig with Black Belt Magazine that's coming up Friday. You know Mark Shuey of the Cane Master?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anyway, he and I are going over to Black Belt Magazine, and we're doing a shoot there, and, you know, a whole article, because it seems like all the Black Belt Hall of Famers, no one gets together and teams up and does anything. So we're going to play around that. I take his cane practice, and, you know, he does it, you know, his way, and I turn it into like a pissed off Marine with a cane. It just shows different applications. So I use all the aspects of the simplicity of the sword when I use the cane, and it just gets in there really, really fast and easy. So like that, or next week, the 29th of May, I'll be over in Virginia working with Dane Harden. Have you ever heard of him?
No, I don't think I have.
Dane Harden is Colonel Harden. He has an article in Black Belt Magazine occasionally. He's the highest decorated combat flight surgeon in the military today.
Wow.
Matter of fact, he started off as a private, and he worked his way to a full colonel. And I do a lot of wounded warrior projects with him. A matter of fact, I was doing one with him and my dad, Bill. And Joe was going to be over, but, you know, Joe died about a week later. You know how that goes.
Oh, yeah.
But Joe and I, you know, we don't go back really far, because where they were, I was over in Japan. But we got together pretty fast and pretty easy, and we were doing these Wounded Warrior things together pretty much. So, yeah, he almost liked me. So yeah, we're still going all over. Like when you change the dates over from August to June 22nd for the Masters Hall of Fame.
Uh huh.
Yeah, I'll be over in Ohio with Kevin Cullen and his whole group doing stuff in the cornfields, I guess.
Oh.
I take your comments.
Well, they have them and stuff like that. But my thing will be teaching sword, of course. And then what happens if you drop your sword? Then we have a magazine, and we work on magazines. And if you drop your magazine, we work on forearms and hands. So we can relate the sword to open hand pretty easy, and you don't have to go from one to another. For example, if you lose your weapon, some people have to think, what am I going to do next? But if you follow the same patterns, you can go in there with elbows, wrists, forearms, hands, or the sword. Doesn't really matter, because it works in the same. Now, it doesn't mean I get beat up, because I've been beat up more than anybody I know. But it's good.
But it's good.
They had to sweat to do it.
I know, Sheehan, you still look so young, nobody believes you're your age.
Hey, you know how it goes. You know how it goes. Yeah,
I wish I did.
I was going to say, yeah, I do, but I didn't want Bob to feel bad. Ah!
You Yeah, I don't know what it is. It just keeps me young. But then again, you know, I don't have to hold back. I can follow through on all my strikes, which means there's no stress. You know, and then when I work with police departments and, you know, the law enforcement areas, it's fun because I get to beat up on cops and eat their donuts, you know, things like that. So, yeah, there's no wrinkles in the face. But they've been slapped off my head so far, so you know how it goes. But,
Absolutely. So, Chihan, what do you think the future holds? I know you were. I get all the emails from you and Sentry. I know you're working a lot with them. What do you hold for Chihan Abbott in the future? Any plans?
Well,
you know,
my kids are in college, so I'm not going far. I've traveling around and doing different things outside the United States. I did all that, you know, when I was younger. So nowadays, it's spending more time dealing with private students. You know, there's a lot of guys that are out there in their 50s or 60s, some of them in their 70s a little bit, and they're like alpha dogs that are retired. And during the time they were, you know, say a lawyer or a dentist or, you know, a salesman, they're just humping so hard. And then when they have a little free time, they go, now I can do this. So I've spent a fair amount of my time just dealing with a lot of private people, too, just because, especially locally. So, you know. It used to be we'd get in there and I'd beat up everybody and I, you know, after 5 minutes they're coughing out their lungs and, you know, one more, can I have another, sir? But now it's sort of like, you know, well, let's talk about etiquette and go have Mexican food.
Love it.
Hey, you know how it goes? Well, you know, when you live the way of the sword and you work it in that way, it isn't like... I run into so many people who are so good because they work out 2 hours a week and they read the book, and the book is the word, but there's more than one book out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what happens is everything, they don't get closed-minded because, you know, but they fall into this pattern that makes it sort of difficult. And it's just, you know, the sword was, at this day and age, in Japan, the sword was made for everybody because that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now there a lot of people might argue with that, but they're not on the phone right now, so there it is. So yeah, I run into lots of interesting people, and I, you know, run into all these really, really good sword people. But then again, you know, no one lives the sword. You know, I've been married to my Japanese wife. I mean, we've known each other for 30 years. We've been married for 26 now. And, you know, I lived the whole thing. And she teaches me how to smell the Japanese roses and cut them correctly with a katana. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times, you know, people that do the sword, they're doing other jobs, you know. They might work here, they might work there, but this is all I do. I just do the sword because... I was too stupid to do anything else after college, you know.
Well, you are living the dream. I mean, it's like, you know, many martial artists dream to do what they love 24/7. And that's the dream.
It's really, really nice. But the problem is, as you can appreciate this, when you start having kids go to college, you go, you know, if I would have done anything else, I would have been a zillionaire. Because in the martial arts... you got to put a lot of energy in it. And then in the last 5 years, I noticed everybody's an expert on the Internet.
Yeah.
You know, if I didn't know my position in the martial arts industry, because, you know, I know everybody and everybody knows me and we all do things together. And there's not very many people in that have a key to the men's room, if that makes any sense, or women's room, you know, it goes, where, you know, and we're co-ed. And it's amazing how, you know, people just belittle you and they're so vindictive in this and that and the other. And, you know, it's amazing how young martial artists today that try to get out of the norm and show that they have a little expertise in something, how much they're held down.
Yeah.
By browbeating. And, you know, no one likes being called everything in the book, you know, just because. So I've come to expect if I don't get hate letters by the second day of the new year, something must be wrong.
Yeah, you know, especially on YouTube, you know, and I know you've got like a great channel on YouTube, and for martial artists out there, got to go check it out. Learn the Sword. Just look up Learn the Sword on YouTube.
It works
it
well. It's practical, easy.
It's a great channel. But yeah, you know, you're right that there's so many experts out there. You know, 16 year
old, which is really, really great. I love all the experts, but they know, but they don't do.
Yeah, yeah.
Knowing isn't doing.
Exactly.
And that's
exactly.
One of the biggest things with a Japanese martial artist, because when you've been doing it since you were 3 years old, and say you're 60 or 70, you know, it's like being a motorcycle cop. You've heard all the excuses before.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's the same thing. It really, really is. But the teachers over there are really, really nice. It's really surprising on how the Japanese teachers are over there compared to all the other ones that can't speak the traditional language. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, 2 hours a week, they'll be a priest for 2 hours a week. Who am I getting mean on people?
Yeah, that's our job.
Oh, okay, that's dirty. Well, you know, hey, well, it's great because I go to a lot of schools, and I run into these schools, and, you know, hey, it's about young kids now because those are the people that pay the rent. I mean, you know, it isn't about the 40-year-old guy anymore. It's about the 80% of young kids. And if you yell at the kids or make them do an extra push-up or make them do this or make them do that, well, I ain't doing that. I'm telling my mom they're going to pull me out of here, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how things have changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Japanese, they spend hours and hours and hours working with you, and they don't have airs about them.
Mm-hmm.
Although when a lot of martial artists say they run into Japanese, and they go, well, you know, they're not really nice. Well, they don't speak English, and they're
mm-hmm.
not taught to be friendly. They're taught to be Japanese, and Japanese have a mindset. Now, if all the people that would like to interact with Japanese better, here's what I say, buy them a drink. Your English
mm-hmm.
will get a lot better, or learn the language. Because if you can learn the language, then you can understand the nuances and everything that deals with the sword and the thought process just
mm-hmm.
because it's there.
Right on. Right on.
Am
well,
I going off on any weird tangents?
No.
Not at all.
Not at all. This is all great information, especially the insights on what it's like to train over there. I mean, I trained very briefly over there doing Kudo.
Yeah.
In Japan, and same thing. They're not gonna, you know, they're not. They don't seem very friendly, but you know, you buy them a drink or you give them a pack of smokes, and you're good to go.
You're good. Whiskey, tobacco, you know, and budo.
Yeah, you're good to go. Well, we are almost out of time. Wow.
Oh, just
Bob.
Getting started.
I know. You know.
We know you were.
I think me and Sifu Bob need to have you on. Have you on as a guest all your own. Because we'd love to talk to you for 2 hours.
Hey, it makes it sort of fun. If you want to, just have a bunch of questions for me next time.
Yeah,
and I'll just
go
off on a tangent.
Yeah, you bet.
You know, that, and that's why they sent me back here to the U.S. is because my English is good. And, you know, I can explain it a lot easier because, you know, when you learn the traditional language, you see the kanji, you know the feeling, you know, you look at it. You can understand it, then you can easily explain it to somebody, well, it's like this or like that, or you can work it in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't cut and dried. It's a lot of gray area, too, because that's the way it is.
Right on. Yeah, we'd love to have you on a show. So, yeah, you know, Sifu Bob, let's see about setting that up sometime after July or whatever, because I think it'd be really cool. We'll even buy you
yes.
a drink, Shihan.
That sounds good to me.
Awesome. So, Bob, you want to close this out, or
I would
before
love
you close
to...
it out.
Go ahead.
If you, I have written, you know, 3 or 4 books, and of course we have lots of DVDs. But you know, one of the websites is SamuraiSports.com, where we deal with all the combatives. LearnTheSword.com, where we can work tradition for the regular guy out there, and of course, Street Smart Samurai.
Awesome.
Listeners, go check out those 3 websites. He's a wonderful instructor, historian, you name it. If it's got to do with the sword, seek out Shihan Dana Abbott. Jihan Dana, thank you so much for being our guest. And we look forward to seeing you maybe next year at the Masters.
Hey, you know, I'll be back there. It's about every other year for me. You know how it goes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We do know that. And it was our pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And you guys have a great evening.
Thanks.
You too, sir.
You too. Thank you to everybody out there,
happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Or all you mothers out there, happy Mother's Day.
Awesome. We'll talk to everybody next week. Stay tuned next week. Next week's our lunchtime show, right, Bob?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
So tune in 11 o'clock next week, the 19th. We'll see everyone next time. Goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.